Well, we can just jump in and we'll see how we go. Greetings, everybody. This is lesson one of the Sector 39 online permaculture design course. I'm sat here with fellow permaculture student, Yossi Berland.
Hello.
And he's just having someone here live with me in the room, sort of helps animate the conversation, and hopefully our sort of chat and questions and things might help bring this to life. It's very difficult to do this remotely, and normally we're all sat together. And I think a big part of the PDC, wouldn't you agree, Yossi, is, you know, it's the cooking, it's the sharing things together, sharing space,
shared energy.
Yeah. And the things that we realize that we all have in common as human beings, which is, you know, lunch, food, sustenance, you know, camaraderie, friendship, all of these things, you know, it's very, very simple things, that the things that make us human. And I think permaculture is also here to remind us that we're all here together.
Yeah.
We're one species ultimately sharing one ecosystem, which is planet Earth, right? So, the first unit in permaculture, well, think of it, there's these 12 principles. I alluded to them in the opening section. We're trying to look at the world as a sort of through a frame. It's not like permaculture is these 12 principles. It's not a definition. It's a useful way of looking at things and framing things. And if you don't find it useful, you can still take these ideas and use them in a way it does make sense to you.
They're not the 12 commandments.
Exactly that. They're sort of 12 perspectives, if you like. And what's nice about them is that they take us through a cycle. So it doesn't really have an end. It doesn't really have a beginning or an end, a bit like the clock. And so we're going to kind of start with principle 12. And I think you kind of think of midnight or midday as being the, you know, and then we'll move into principle one, will be kind of the second thing that we'll, area that we'll look at. And so we're all united by certain constants. So we're on this planet, sharing this planet together, and sunshine and stuff like that. But also the fact that we're breathing the air. And this ecosystem we're part of is constantly changing. And it's shaped, those changes and patterns are shaped by the behaviors of every single component within that system as well. So I'm going to try and start this whole process by trying to get you to think big, to think at the, on the, what you might say, the meta scale, really the overarching bigger scale. Think beyond your own personal problems, beyond your own, you know, individual life experience, your environment, the limitations of your home and resources and climate. And let's just all allow ourselves to sort of take a step back and look at the bigger picture. You know, the way that we receive information is filtered through sort of the scientific process. And the scientific process is based in observation, not in belief. Beliefs are very important, and they help kind of navigate us on a spiritual, ethical level, maybe. But we also, the thing that we all have in common, if you like, is this observation. What we can measure? And science brings that to us. And when we turn to the science, what we know right now is that the world is at a time of absolute emergency, of really an enormous challenge as facing us, and it's what we loosely call climate change. It's a very loose term, though, to describe a hugely, you know, dynamic and complex problem. What we can say, though, that there's a scientific body that was established in 1985 to formally look and analyze all of the sort of climate data. So it's now become the most studied subject in the history of science. You know, we've never had more scientists working in these areas. We've never had more computing power. We've never had more raw data to look at. And please understand me, there is no disagreement within the scientific community about the reality, the ferocity, and the long-term implications of what we might call climate change. This is really real. As much as the COVID virus is real and affecting us in a real way, there's a much bigger sort of set of things that we need to be thinking about. I don't mean to scare you, but I need to frame where we're at in reality, okay?
Once it enters the political world, then it becomes a bit more about arguing and blaming, but the scientists are
absolutely clear.
100%
Yes. And in the political world, as you say, things become distorted by perspectives of, you know, individual experience and what have you. Is science is the ground on which we stand, and the data is just immense. And because they've been able to look at the sediments at the bottom of the oceans, and they can tell when the ice, when the glaciers melted in North America, how many thousands of years ago, you can just imagine all of the particles of rock and things that have been washed down into the ocean. If you drill down into the ocean and you analyze those rock particles, they completely correspond with, let's say, the air bubbles trapped in the ice that's still there on the North Pole and the Greenland ice sheet. They have an staggering amount of data.
Yeah.
And they look at it from every single possible viewpoint, the rings in trees, the geological formations, there's just so many different ways.
Yeah.
And they all form a common picture that again, which there is no dispute about, which is that the atmosphere and the climate of Earth has constantly changed. Mm. Yes, it has over a long, and actually the data that we have now goes back several millions of years. So there's been times when carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are higher than they are now and times when they've been lower. But in terms of comparative to today, and we're looking at a graph here going, it goes back 400,000 years. Now, don't forget that in that time, Homo sapiens, our species, only evolved in the last 200,000 years. That everything that we regard as normal has happened within a variance I feel like I'm getting technical already. Is the air that we breathe is what? It's in some part oxygen. We breathe in oxygen. We breathe out carbon dioxide. In fact, we breathe out a mixture of oxygen and carbon dioxide. But actually, 80%, the majority of the air that we breathe, the air that they say is nitrogen.
Right.
And that's got nothing to do with anything. Like, it's an inert gas. We breathe it in, we breathe it out. We don't interact with it.
Yeah.
So the carbon and oxygen bits, carbon dioxide and oxygen parts of that, the things that we're most interested in. And what scientists have observed is this fact is that going back actually 2 million years, I'm showing you a graph of 400,000 years, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has never been higher than 300 parts per million. It was about 280 parts per million when the Industrial Revolution got going.
So, beginning of the 19th century.
Yeah, we go back 200 years,
yeah.
And it was 285 parts per million.
Yeah.
It's now 415. It's a third as much again.
Mm.
And again, what we know about carbon dioxide is that it traps heat in the atmosphere. It's just like a thermal blanket.
Yeah.
So the heat coming in from the sun is leaving more slowly than it was before, which means the planet is heating up and it's changing our climate systems.
Yeah.
This talk is supported by a series of videos. The science is very, very well explained, and we'll make sure we'll link to that.
Yeah.
And we have a great explanation in 4 minutes from Neil deGrasse Tyson. Or if you want to go right to the top to Professor Johan Rockström, there's a 57 minutes lecture, which I really, sponsored by the World Wildlife Fund. I really recommend everybody really should be know this science.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're going to talk about the consequences of it, really, rather than the mechanism of climate change. But this is the world we're in. So this is the second slide where it says four energy futures. This is a little bit complicated, but what this is kind of saying is, and we actually don't know what's going to happen next. And anybody who tells you they think they know the future is kind of have suspicion.
Yeah.
And again, in the teaching of permaculture, I do try and stress the fact is I'm not trying to persuade you to believe anything. I'm not trying to convince you of something. What I'm doing is sharing my perspective, and I encourage you to go away and check what the ideas and things that we're confronting you with your own perspective. Think about these ideas from your own
challenge.
Yeah. So we can look at our graph, and as one of the pathways of the possible futures, you can see over time the number of people on the planet, the amount of farmed land, the amount of mining, the amount of coal burning, you know, our total ecological impact has just done nothing but accelerate. And to a large extent, that's created wealth and material goods for lots of people, and it's helped population grow and raise many people out of poverty. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But all of that development has happened in a world in which there was a lot of wilderness and not many people.
Mm.
And what happens when something, the amount of people keeps rising and the wilderness keeps receding. And we're now at a point now where if we double the population and half what's left of the forest is, I'm afraid it's over. We would have destroyed the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And that's what this sort of techno explosion option on the graph is kind of saying, is we think we can just carry on as we are, where everyone's going to get a car and a fridge and an air conditioner and an iPhone and whatever. And I'm afraid it's not going to happen. And that leads us to some kind of horrific collapse.
That's what we're told we can all have.
Yes.
If we work hard enough, but it's not necessarily a good thing. In fact, it could be the end of us.
And it wouldn't work if everybody had it, yeah. Especially not in a way in which we have it in a very throwaway way.
Of course.
You know? And maybe the iPhones and things are all very, very important, but what about just all those plastic bottles? So just think about the long-term effect of this sort of throwaway technological sort of culture that we have. And you know, some countries in reality is already experiencing collapse. You know, their economies are in dire straits, and you know, a series of bad things happen. People in Somalia, we think about what's happening there, or even in Puerto Rico, I know, hit by a hurricane, you know, hit by an economic disaster, now they're hit by COVID-19.
Yeah.
You know, how resilient are our societies to these external shocks? There's a lovely idea of sort of green technology, the techno stability. If we could just simplify our lives a little bit, be a little less greedy, maybe we could find a kind of a green future that would be beneficial for all. And
yeah.
Hey, I'm all for it. Don't get me wrong. You know,
yeah.
Solar panels, wind turbines, and all of that. We can meet our needs in many ways.
Yeah.
But the truth is, that doesn't speak to the crisis that we're in. Mm. It takes decades to develop and implement these things.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of planning and consistent investment. And, you know, to a fair degree, the world's still investing in the wrong things, you know, and we're still fighting wars and going chasing after finite resources. All of that's got to stop.
So it is what we want moving forward. It is a positive thing, but it's not going to be the answer to the question.
Yeah, we're not going to jump to it tomorrow. It's going to take 30, 40, 50 years to build a green tech world, right? So what else we've left with is, you know, some people, I mean, thinking of our friends in Bidi Bidi and Maji up in the Western Nile, is they're almost in a collapse situation. They're through warfare, they're displaced people. They're having to start again with nothing. What David Holmgren, Permaculture author, calls the lifeboats scenario.
Yeah.
And you can build back up from there. We've seen it. We've worked with people in refugee settlement situations, and it's tough as hell. It's really, really, really difficult. But actually, just using the resources around them by prioritizing meeting human needs first, and food and hygiene and basic accommodation and security, actually, you can get back to a usable society again. Permaculture is a tool that will allow us to take what we've got, the tools that we've got, the remnants of the society that is collapsing, and refashion it into something else. And make it into something that fits the ethics that we started to touch on, the values that are so important, but also start to meet our needs in a more creative way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want us to live quality lives, and the human experience is complex and involves art and literature as much as potatoes and cassava. But we've got to get those things in the right order.
Sure.
And by planning, by collaborating, and by understanding our relationship with the natural world much, much better, we can find, open up this third way, this other way this permaculture response, this permaculture pathway. And I really invite you to join us on this journey, because I think this is the point in time that we've got to. We're kind of experiencing a collapse caused by a virus, but it's making us realize our economies are so vulnerable, and you know, we haven't got spare resources. And what is the fallback system if the global system does let us down?
Yeah.
Okay. So back in 1992, the world had its first environmental summit, crisis summit. It was called the Rio Earth Summit, 1992, held in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And the global community came together, led by science, and said, look, guys, we're on the wrong path of development. We have to change. All the alarm bells are ringing. And that was really the first time, well, we'd had the IPCC made its initial reports before that, but we were given this concept of sustainability. We need to achieve a form of development that is not actually at the aggressive cost of destroying the natural world, but that it's actually a balancing point, you know, it's something that actually we could continue on doing, you know, into time. Our children's 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 children. We should be thinking of the seventh generation, how the choices that we make today impact on our distant and future ancestors. Yeah. A friend of mine, Angela, said once in one of our workshops, she says, I started to think very consciously about how I want to be remembered as an ancestor. What kind of ancestor do you want to be to your great-great-great-great-grandchildren, right? Yeah. So, the bottom line is, we've eroded into the natural world so much, we've cut down so much of the forest, we've poisoned the rivers, we've changed the atmosphere to such a degree that the concept of being sustainable is kind of a long way off.
Mm.
Sustainable doesn't look like any of the things that we're currently doing.
Yeah.
Okay. So, a permaculture author, Toby Hemingway, put it kind of rather beautifully, and he said, imagine a continuum, a line running infinitely, you know, left and right. Sustainable is the midpoint of that line. It's not your objective. It's like what the minimum you're aiming for is, that it's just about sustainable. You know, he makes the joke. He said, if you ask about your marriage and say, oh, how's your relationship with your wife? And you say, sustainable, just about bear it a bit longer. We're going to be doing better than sustainable. Sustainable is the minimum.
Yes.
So David Holmgren and his brilliant book, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, his permaculture book, he's saying that permaculture is a journey beyond sustainability. It's a journey of regeneration, of restoration,
repair.
And we don't necessarily know how to do that, but we've got a lot to learn. And I think once you are on that journey, and I'm inviting you to join us on that journey right now, everything about your life changes. It becomes about problem solving. And permaculture is about trying to use available information to solve problems, to move forward, to create opportunities, firstly for yourself, but for the community around you, and in a way that speaks to and enhances and resonates positively with the natural world, which we're all very much part of.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to think about our permaculture journey as a journey that's taking us in the direction of healing and repairing, a very smart use of natural materials and of the natural energies which are there around us all the time. And once we understand that nature in itself is infinite, the actual idea of scarcity starts to fall away. We realize the things that we really need to sustain us are around us already. We just need to know how to use them and utilize them in a strategic way.
Yeah.
So again, I stress it again, permaculture is a strategy.
Yes.
It's a design process that leads us beyond sustainable. Sustainable was what we aimed for in 1992.
So it's a way of planning for the future, for our grandkids and great-grandkids.
Exactly that.
Forward thinking.
And I think actually it gives us a language that allows us to talk about it.
Yeah.
Right? So, because I don't think we have very many words in our vocabulary that are about the regenerative, restorative journey, how we, you know, enhance and protect and you know, the biodiversity around us and build more complex communities. We've been encouraged to be consumers, to chase after individual goals that are about objects and what we consume or holidays that we have, and, you know, rather than having strategies that create abundance, so rather than consuming resources to have a nice holiday on a desert island, you're actually using resources to build a food forest that might sustain your grandchildren.
Right.
That's the difference.
Right.
And it doesn't mean you can't have holidays within that reality, but the purpose of your life isn't the holiday. The purpose of your life is restoration and regeneration. So lesson number one, permaculture to the world really is, come and join us.
We're on
this journey. Anyway, here we go. So this I'm going to show you what this journey looks like. And this is, again, I'm keeping the big picture here. This is you might hear some random noises in the background. We do have a small dog as a company. It was kind of asleep, but and also just to take a pause, because just kind of opening speech there is just really welcome everybody. I want this to be a journey. I don't want this just to be the transformation, me giving you information. If you're here just thinking it's going to be a gardening course, then you came to the wrong place. I'm sorry. Permaculture is about growing and the landscape and everything. It's so much more than that.
Sure.
And here we are at the big picture end of the thing, of the story as well. So I'm going to introduce you to the Paris Climate Agreement. This is, as you so rightly said, actually, earlier, Yossi, is there's what science says, and then there's how that science, then politicians and economists and what have you, twist that science to fit their models of what they need to do to create GDP growth and dollars and pay interest rates and stuff. But actually, all of those things are a subset of what the planet wants. And what the planet wants is us to stop emitting carbon. It's really, really clearly. Now, we've set up systems that are complicated and distant and reliant on fossil fuels. So if we were to switch them off tomorrow, if they were to be switched off tomorrow, and again, that might happen. I mean, you know, but a lot of people are going to suffer very quickly because that's our food supply. So the question is, how quickly can we wean ourselves off this without crashing the ecosystem, and or maybe without crashing the economy? The Paris Agreement is the compromise of those two things.
Oh.
It's what the science is saying, you're going to need to go to zero tomorrow, mate. Yeah. And it's the politician saying, whoa, that ain't happening because, you know,
XYZ.
Yeah. We've built a global infrastructure around oil, pipelines, tankers, drilling derricks.
Farming is very reliant on it.
All of that. Yeah. So the truth of it is we currently emit 40 billion tons of carbon a year collectively through our economic endeavours. And most of those emissions are emitted actually by a very small part of the economy and a very small number of people. So people tuning in from Uganda maybe or Tanzania, it ain't your emissions that's causing the problem. You need to think a lot about reforestation and protecting degraded soils, because there's many, many aspects to this. But in terms of the, you know, it's not a blame game, actually. And anyone who's looking at our book, Small and Slow Solutions, we put in there, it's a no blame game. We didn't necessarily know back then, certainly 200 years ago, but we know now.